Okay, welcome back to the Greg Kelly podcast. I have not worked out yet, but I have worked out now 6 days in a row. I'm doing this system that I did 20 years ago. It kind of worked and it kind of didn't 20 years ago, but this time I think it's working. Guy's name is Bill Phillips. He started the Body for Life system. It's a 3-month transformation. That's one of their programs. So I took my before photos and, well, so far so good. Not ready for any picture anytime soon with my shirt off, but, I've done the thing every single day. It's only 25 minutes and, there's no ab workout. And I actually reached out to the company. I'm like, what's up? Last time there was an ab workout. And they said they've redesigned the program, and since you work your core so much, which I believe is the mid-chest region to your waist, that they don't have to have a specific workout for that. Anyway, I'm feeling like sore for the first time, like a good kind of sore, you know, like because I could only, we only have 8-pound dumbbells in the house. I know, that's very light. And then I got my hands on 15-pound dumbbells. That's more like it, but only got those actually yesterday. I can lift a lot of weight, but now I'm doing heavier or more reps. And I'm feeling this soreness. And I've always heard if you want to be cut, you know, if you want to be lean, lighter weight, more reps, something like that. Anyway, so far so good. The diet is okay. I had an exception or two this past week, but a pretty decent start. And I like that it's a pretty quick workout too. I'm also thinking that if this thing does work out, and if I see all kinds of results, I may not have to bother with the gym anymore. You know, I got into pretty good shape just by running around, you know, going for a run, putting sneakers on and running outside. How many people have signed up for some gym and never, you know, followed through? However, there's some great, look, I know, what is that CrossFit thing people love? And you know, it's nice going to the gym, community and that kind of stuff, but I have not had all that much success. In the meantime, Maya Zumwalt, who executive produces this show and a lot of other projects that I'm involved in, well, get this. Zumwalt is a very famous name. When I first met her 19 years ago, I'm like, are you related to the Admiral Zumwalt? And she was Admiral Zumwalt. Elmo Zumwalt was the chief of naval operations during Vietnam. Very famous sailor, possibly one of the famous sailors in the history of sailing. So anyway, we bonded over that, and then we had a lot of other things in common and became friends. The Zumwalts, being naval royalty, have a ship named after them. Not only a ship, but a class of ships, the Zumwalt class, of which the Lyndon Johnson is a member, which is pretty wild when you think about it, just to give you an idea of just how illustrious this man's reputation was in the Navy and beyond. So being that they're making the ship, you know, you don't just make it in a weekend. It's like a big thing. First, there's the contracting process and there's procurement. And then I think it takes about 10 years or something like that to actually make a ship, or maybe not to physically make the ship, but what the hell do I know about shipmaking? We're going to meet a guy who makes ships for a living. His name is Larry Stegna. Boy, what a great American. You know, sometimes, I talked to him about this. He's a shipbuilder, okay? He worked at the Bath Iron Works up in Maine. And sometimes we think that, or I think, I don't want to speak for anybody else, that, you know, there's, if you really want to succeed in life, you must go to college. Well, that's not true. Number one, college is so ridiculously expensive now that you could spend that money on a lot of other things, invest it. If you're not going to sit around reading Euclid, I blew off college. I had such a totally wasted it. I still feel guilty to this day. You know, would I have been better off learning a skill that I could have applied? Look, I am glad I went to college. I did learn some things, but when you're 18 and foolish, you do foolish things and you have foolish priorities. And this man we're about to meet, Larry, didn't seem to have any foolish priorities. He had a passion. He enjoyed electrical work and working with metal. He showed aptitude for it at an early age and continued with that, developed an extraordinary expertise, and had an extremely successful and fulfilling career working for probably the premier shipbuilding company in the world, Bath Iron Works, up in Maine. And by the way, it sounds like a really good company, because just talking to this guy and how much reverence he had for his employer and the people he worked with, there aren't many people who will speak like this. And Larry grew up in Ohio and then moved to Maine for this opportunity. And I think that you're going to like him. I found him to be fascinating. I never thought about shipbuilding that much. Who does it? Although, oh my goodness, how did I not know this? And I didn't bring it up during the conversation. Darn. Although I don't know too much about it. My grandfather, my father's father, worked for a time as a shipbuilder at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Forgot about that. He was also a milkman for a while, and he worked for the IRS. I got to follow up with my dad about that. Shipbuilding was not his primary career by any means. I got to find out. Anyway, shipbuilding is really, really complicated, and Larry Stegna tells us about that, his life, and developing a craft, becoming really good at something. Along the way, he becomes a pilot and meets some pretty interesting people and creates the most beautiful memorial to honor Admiral Zumwalt's son, Elmo Zumwalt III, who died very early. He was only in his early 40s real tragedy. Famous story that he may have died as a result of being exposed to Agent Orange during Vietnam, and Elmo Zumwalt, the admiral, was the one who ordered the use of Agent Orange in Vietnam, and his son was exposed to it, who was working in the Navy, was a lieutenant in the Navy. So, remarkable. In the meantime, well, give me one moment here. I do want to tell you about something that is pretty neat. There's a neat solution to a bad problem that's getting ripped off. And now that the world is opening up again, I thought I'd get my passport renewed. So I went online to research passport renewal services, and the prices are like $150, $200, $280, not including passport photos or the government fee. So I sniffed around and I realized that all of the ads that I was seeing were from the same company. That's wrong. I got to call into the State Department. We're going to get through this and see what that's all about. Is that on the up and up? I'm not so sure. In the meantime, have you heard about It's Easy? A friend told me about It's Easy, and they have exceptional 5-star passport renewal service. That's under $35, and that is more like it, $35. Wow. I downloaded the It's Easy app, and guess what? It was totally easy. You just fill out the application, take your complimentary passport photo with your own phone, and yes, you take your complimentary passport photo with your own phone. You don't have to go to the drugstore. You don't have to go to the passport photo shop because they take it in the special certain way the State Department wants it. No, you can take the picture with your own phone. The app allows you to do that. What you do is print out the application that It's Easy immediately emails you with the trackable shipping label that's also included. All you have to do is print it out, send it in with your most recent passport photo. I'm sorry, your most recent passport, because they already have the picture, you emailed it to them. So you send it in with your most recent passport, and that's it. It is so easy, so affordable, under $35. Not the hundreds of dollars other companies are trying to milk from you. I realized It's Easy has been in business for 40 years, so you are getting 40 years of value, a five-star company that you can 100% trust with your documents. So if you have to get a passport, I'm telling you, there is no other way. It's easy. Download the app from the Apple or Android app store today. Do yourself a favor. Don't be fooled. When you need a passport renewed, think It's Easy. Just spell it out. It's easy. ITSEASY. It's easy. It's easy. It sure is. So, in the meantime, I'm very excited to introduce you to my new friend, Larry Stegna, truly a great American. By the way, you're in Maine right now, and have you always lived up there?
No, my family came from Youngstown, Ohio. I was born there on Valentine's Day, 1957, and Youngstown's a steel town, as you know. And when I was 20 years old, the steel mills all started to close down, and it affected the economy in Youngstown really bad. And my dad wanted to move us out of Youngstown somewhere where it was safer and where there was employment. And we had vacationed in Maine in 70 and in 73. So in 79, late 79, he and my mom sold our house, and we moved up here to Maine and to get jobs at Bath Iron Works. And my father got a job instantly in 1979, and I got a job 1 month later.
Wow. Wait, first, back in Youngstown, do you have siblings?
Yes, I did. They eventually moved up here themselves because they came up to visit. They saw how nice it was. And my brother Tim actually worked there for a little while himself.
Did your dad work in the steel mills in Youngstown?
Youngstown. Pardon me?
He worked in the steel industry in Ohio.
Yes.
So what was your, let me just ask you a little bit about, what year did you move? I guess you just answered it. You moved when you were about 20, right?
Yes.
Did you ever work in the steel industry yourself?
No, I didn't. I worked in the automobile industry, and I also, through high school, I took electronics, and I worked for Admiral. I did warranty work on televisions and radios and stuff, and that's how I eventually got the job at Bath Iron Works as an electrician, because I was an electronics specialist.
Admiral Televisions. Wait, that was an old-time brand. They were very big, right?
Yes, yes. And what happened was, when I was in school and I used to build radios and ham radios and shortwave radios and stuff like that, and I used to enjoy buying old radios at Goodwill and Salvation Army and bringing them home and tearing them apart and trying to put them back together so they'd work again. And one day I found an old television set next to the road, big wooden case one, Admiral, and it had a blown picture tube. So I thought this would be kind of cool to bring home to my parents and see if I could fix it. So I did. And I went to the local Admiral dealer and bought a picture tube. And they were fascinated that a 17-year-old was doing that. Brought the picture tube home, put it in the television, got it working. And I also at the time did something was pretty radical, as I ran a wire from the speakers to my father's chair with a volume control on it, because he hated commercials. So that he could turn the television down when commercials came on. So when the Admiral people saw that, they were kind of impressed with my ability. So they offered me a job to work for one of their subcontractors. It was called Public TV, and they did the warranty work on all the entertainment stuff. And I also worked on some of the. They had motels, a motel chain that had televisions, and you know, they had the lock in the side when you had to pay a little extra to watch TV. And I would drill holes in TVs and put locks so that when people paid, they could watch TV in their hotel. That anyway, I did all that kind of stuff, and I really enjoyed doing it. And that, along with many other things, got me into Bath Iron Works.
That's funny. I do remember. I mean, I was a very young kid, and we were in some hotel, but I remember a TV like that that you had to pay to watch. with coins, I think, quarters perhaps. So let me ask you this, just in high school, these are the subjects you liked, where you were science oriented or shop, auto mechanics. What kind of subjects did you like or prefer?
It was electronics, woodworking, but especially metals and welding, because my father was in the automobile industry, like I told you, and it was all automobile oriented growing up. It's all that I wanted to do We went to stock car races, motorcycle races, drag races, everything. And all of my heroes back then that I wanted to emulate were those high-performance-oriented men. And all I ever wanted to do was to metals and welding. And a funny story that the day he died, my father thought was so ironic was that when I took my aptitude test when I was in the eighth grade for any type of industrial arts in high school, when I went to high school, they looked at my aptitude test, and I had chosen metals and welding because that's all I wanted to do. And they said, Mr. Stegna, you really don't have the aptitude for metals and welding, so we're going to put you in electronics and woodworking. Well, being, you know, 13, 14 years old, didn't matter to me. All I was thinking about was girls anyway. So anyway, I took those classes and loved it. But I've been working with metals and welding ever since. I've been welding cars and aircraft fuselages. And right now I'm restoring antique vehicles for my brother. I've got four welders at home. And anyway, it's a pretty funny story. But those were my subjects: woodworking, electronics, and metals and welding.
Now, ultimately, you became a marine electrician. That's the correct title, right?
Yes.
Now, they told you that you had no aptitude in welding and metal.
That's what my guidance counselor said when I was in high school in 1971.
Now, technically, I guess, I mean, did that, which I'm guessing you, it sounds like bad advice, or sounds like, you know, how dare they, or sounds like how could they know those aptitude tests or whatever, but I can't tell if that actually did affect your career trajectory or not. You know, because I guess it did, right?
No, it didn't affect it, because I was going to do it anyway. It wasn't like I was trying to prove a point. It was, that's what I wanted to do. I mean, I must be genetically predisposed to it. Maybe three or four generations ago, my relatives were blacksmiths or something, but that's all I've ever wanted to do, and that's all I've ever done. And, you know,
For me, and forgive me, because I don't know a lot about these industries or these professions, but you became an electrician. That's different from a welder.
Oh, okay. I see where you're going now. Well, actually, both of those... both of those specialties apply to being an electrician in a shipyard, because you've brought up a really good point, because the ship, of course, is made of metal, and all of the foundations for all of the equipment are metal. So you have to do a lot of cutting and drilling and welding to electricians put up our own foundations for those pieces of equipment. So you have to be proficient at welding. You have to go through school at the shipyard, and you have to be tested. And you have to be licensed, because the Navy won't let you do tack welding or any welding on their ship unless you have gone through those procedures. So my electronics training and my welding training that I got from my father and did on my own and over the years, and then the schooling that I took at Bath Iron Works when I got there, those all applied perfectly to being a marine electrician, because you use those talents every single day.
And like a lot of other professions, any skill, I mean, it's a lifetime of learning and applying. It's not like you get certified and you know all there is to know, right? I mean, it's a never-ending process. You're always getting better, more experienced, learning more, correct?
That's exactly, I think that exact thought a lot, because every day I'm learning something. Even when I'm not at the shipyard now, I'm working on other different things, like vehicles, a different way to weld, a different way to make a piece, a different way to modify a piece. So it's never, nobody knows everything. Maybe some people think they do, but that's what's so stimulating about it, is because you're always learning. And speaking of learning, on the Zumwalt ship is the first one named for Admiral Zumwalt. I learned so much on that ship. That was the most stimulating ship that I ever worked on, because everything on it was new. The design was new. The methods were new. Even the measurements were new. It was in metric versus fractions. You know, everything was so new on that ship that when I got on it, it was in a period of time in my life. It was just a few years after my father had died, and I was looking for something really stimulating, something new, to like a new chapter in my life. And that's when that ship came into my life. And
what year was that?
My goodness. Pardon me?
What year was that about?
2011, 2012.
Okay. So before we get into that, how many ships have you worked on? Do you have a number? Do you know?
Yes, it's over 70.
70 different ships. All right.
Uh-huh.
I want to come back to that. If I could take you back, though, to high school, you're learning these things. And what else did your guidance counselor suggest? And by the way, I don't think anyone has ever been, look, I know there are some guidance counselors out there and that are good. I've yet to meet them. I just got some terrible advice from my guidance counselor. I mean, it was just like all my dreams were crushed as soon as I spoke to him. And they're kind of notorious. I know that they're good guidance counselors. I know they mean well, but I just, anyway, personally, anecdotally, you, me, we got some bad advice. Fortunately, we didn't listen. But did your guidance counselor, anybody, encourage you to think about college?
No.
Why not?
Well, I'm not sure why their reasoning for not doing that was, but I never considered college, quite frankly, because my family was very humble means. Both of my parents worked. My mother was a florist, and my father worked two full-time jobs. My parents have four kids, and this was in Youngstown. And in hindsight, looking at how they did it, I'm amazed, because my wife and I raised one daughter, and we had our economic issues. I don't know how my parents did it in Youngstown in the 60s and up to the mid-70s with four kids. But the subject of college never came up. It wasn't even considered, and it wasn't a disappointment to me. I don't want you to think that, because all I wanted to do was what my father did. That was the honest truth. I didn't think about a career. I didn't think about the military. I'm from a generation when the draft ended, Vietnam War ended, and my parents knew that they were going to be leaving Youngstown because the steel mills were already starting to wind down, and ultimately they started closing down in 77. I never considered anything through my teen years, my formative years, other than supporting my family and going wherever they went. It was number one. It was like when we moved up here to Maine, it was very much like John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. You know, I mean, my family picked up everything, put it in a 20-foot office trailer, and brought it up to Maine, not knowing where we were going to live, not even knowing if we were going to work at Bath Iron Works. I mean, everything was in our, all of our armor was held on with one bolt. You know, it was a risk that makes my father the bravest, the most brilliant man I've ever met. So back to your original college question, never even considered it. And don't regret not doing it, because if I had, I wouldn't be sitting here right now talking to you about my career at Bath Iron Works.
What was your father's name?
Lawrence Sr., Lawrence with a W.
And your mom?
Barbara Jean, J-E-A-N.
So, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned you were born in 1957, so that makes you, what, 64. 64. You know, it is interesting. Let me just share this with you and tell me if I'm crazy, but you are 64. Now, there was a time when you were a kid, you know, somebody in 1977, you were 20, and
yes.
A man who was 64 was born in 1912 or so, and a person, you know, would have been in their prime of life during World War II. I guess it's interesting. We're in this era. You're a person of a certain age. You're 64. When you were in your teens and 20s, you know, let's face it, disco music was cool, was a thing, which is still cool. It's not that long ago, I guess is what I'm trying to say. The music is still relevant. The culture is more relevant than we realize. Somebody once said to me, and I saw it on Twitter, it's 2020. The year 1980 to 2020 seems a lot shorter than 1940 to 1980. Does that make sense at all? It's just kind of curious.
I think of that concept quite often, to tell you the truth. I do put periods of time in perspective. I do that quite a bit. I think about what I was doing in 1980 and listen, we weren't listening to 1940s music
right.
in 1980. But in 2021, we are listening to 1980s music. So I do think about that. That's cool.
So, by the way, you mentioned The Grapes of Wrath and John Steinbeck, which is a book I've attempted to read. I've only read one, Of Mice and Men, by John Steinbeck. But I'm just curious, are you a reader?
Yes.
What do you like to read, and when do you read?
Most of the time I read history, although growing up we did read the classics. You know, we read that. We read stuff that I read in school, you know, like 12 Angry Men, Fahrenheit 451. We read the classics. I don't read a whole lot right now other than historical things. My father-in-law, Ralph Bond, he's a World War II veteran. He lives with us. He's almost 98 years old. So there are history books everywhere here. And he gets the Legion newsletter, and I read that. And that's what I read.
How often are you ever confronted with people who think that to be considered educated, you need to have gone to college, and to be of a certain status in America? You know, if you haven't gone to college, look, I can tell already, you know, you're very smart and well read, and you've read probably more books than I have. And I went the college route. And anyway, what am I trying to say here? I'm dancing around it. You're as smart as anybody out there, if not a lot smarter, and yet there are people who in this society who still think, well, if you didn't go to college, you know, you're just not all that. Are you ever, and forgive me for bringing it up, maybe you've never even thought of these things, but there are people out there who think about that. And I remember when I thought about in high school, and, you know, I wasn't doing so well. And at one point I wanted to quit high school and those kinds of things. And I was fearful of how that would be regarded in my community. Do you know what I'm saying? And does it ever come up in conversation that, okay, you didn't go to college, why not? You're blue collar. Do you feel that anybody ever judges you because of that?
I'm sure that they do, but they haven't confronted me with it. That wouldn't be a good idea. And they just wouldn't. I think you're talking about snobs, and snobs kind of fascinate me, you know, because people that think they're better than other people really, truly fascinate me, because they're putting themselves at a disadvantage because nobody's better than anyone else.
Quite literally. I mean, it's like God created all of us, and we all have a purpose. We all have a mission, and it all kind of this earthly life, I believe, I mean, it's a test in many ways, and it's a trial, but, you know, we can't take any of this stuff with us, and we're going to be, we will be judged, and we're not going to be judged for the things that society judges us for, I think.
I agree with everything you're saying there. As far as college, though, I never really wanted to go myself, but my wife and I wanted, insisted, and put our daughter through college because of my daughter's desires, and I knew, and I used to say, Holly, you need that piece of paper. I have a pretty good intelligence level, but I can't make it in certain things, even at Bath Iron Works, because I don't have that engineering degree. I don't have that piece of paper. So you've got to go to college, and she wanted to, and she did. You've got to have that magic piece of paper, which will open those doors for you. I totally agree with you regarding college, but I don't have any regrets about not going. My wife's a college graduate, and now my daughter is, and I'm quite proud. But quite frankly, in my life, I wouldn't change a thing. I'm very pleased. I'm a man that lives very humble means, and my successes are they're in my heart. The things that I've accomplished, people that I appreciate, people that I love, people that I'm loyal to, people that I aspire to be like. So college doesn't. If someone thinks that they're better than me because they went to college, then I'm glad they feel that way.
Well, ultimately, somebody who thinks they're better than somebody, that is a disadvantage. That is like a disadvantage for that person who thinks they're better.
The only people that are better are are my mother and Jesus.
Oh, how true. I was thinking about a book. Now, I'll tell you about that some other time, but I feel the same way about my mother and Jesus, by the way. So, 1979, your father is hired by Bath Iron Works. What was his job? Or what was he
Marine
hired as?
Christian. Yep. And he got in because it just shows his genius. We went to the employment department. We walked in. It was old school. You know, they had that felt type with the white push-in letters that displayed the opportunities at the shipyard. We walked in there, 20, 30 guys in there filled with cigarette smoke. And my father's 47 years old, and, you know, he has on his professional service department clothes, and, you know, he's got arms like Popeye, and he's got a flat top haircut and the horn-rimmed glasses and the black work shoes. And I walk in, and I'm baby-faced, and he looked up at that, and they were hiring electricians. Well, he had been what was called a motor inspector in the steel mill, which was a maintenance electrician. So based on that, and they weren't hiring welders or painters, which is what I was going to apply for, which they did apply for. And he applied as an electrician, and the lady there looked at my father and did not want to let him go. And I believe that day, we're talking about 42 years now, but I believe that they took him right back into the office, and one of the managers gave him a brief interview right then and scheduled a formal interview a week or two later with the departmental foreman. But he was hired immediately, and he got in, and, you know, of course his workmanship was, and his abilities and his creativity were off the charts. And the men there, his supervisor and his supervisor's assistant foreman, saw what he was doing, and they said, "Larry, do you know anybody that's as good as you?" And being the perfect father, well, I'm the luckiest boy that was ever born, he said, "If you think I know a lot, you should see my son." 3 weeks later, I was working at Bath Iron Works.
That's
because of my father. He opened that door for me like he opened every single door in my life.
Now, did you have the same job as your father?
I'm sorry, what?
Did you have the same job, same position as your father?
Yes, I did. Yes. Marine electrician. Yeah.
Now,
and we worked together on many, many, many ships right up until the day he died. The last ship that we worked on together was the future USS Bainbridge. And it was a DDG 51 class. And but you want to hear an interesting story. This is really cool. The last ship that we worked on was the Bainbridge. And the first job that I ever worked on in my life was with my father in 1971. It was at an auto dealership in Youngstown called Stackhouse Oles. And we worked with a World War II veteran named Bob Bainbridge.
Oh, wow.
So we worked with Bob Bainbridge at the first part of at the beginning of my career, and at the end of my career, where we worked on the USS Bainbridge. Isn't that wild?
That is wild. Any relation this Bainbridge to the Bainbridge?
No, I don't believe so. If you look up the name Bainbridge, I think he was a hero, like Revolutionary War hero or something
right.
like that. Really, really old name.
That is wild.
I'll give you another one. If
yeah.
you want to hear another one, at the same dealership, we worked for a man named Bill Dugan. That was the guy that ran the show at the dealership. And the president of Bath Iron Works, when my dad died, was Dugan Shipway.
Shipway was his name?
Shipway, Shipway.
That was the name of the guy who ran
the shipyard.
What a name. Look.
He was Mr. Shipway. Dugan Shipway was so popular at Bath Iron Works. He's a great man. He's a Navy man. He was so... People at the shipyard just loved him. He'd drive around in his Jeep, and he'd wave at people, and he'd talk to everyone, and he was a very humble man. I really enjoyed working for that man.
So if we could a little bit, just tell me, if you can, about Bath Iron Works. My understanding is it was one location. It wasn't like a multinational corporation or anything like that had chapters all over the place. It was just in Maine.
Right. Well, Bath Iron Works is owned by General Dynamics, and they're all over.
But were they weren't always owned by General Dynamics.
No. I forget when General Dynamics bought them. But before General Dynamics, they were owned by a group of insurance companies, Prudential and Aetna. And then before that, they were actually owned by Congolium, the tile company. But General Dynamics has owned them for several years.
But Bath Iron Works is, the shorthand, is a shipbuilding company.
Yes, it is. Yes, and it's in Bath, Maine. And they have a couple of satellite they have what's called the Hardings plant in Brunswick. It's about 7 miles away. And they have warehouses in Brunswick about 5 miles away, because they're a little bit restricted in the right in the town of Bath. So they have other satellite satellite facilities elsewhere. It's a really nice setup. It really is.
So, by the way, you said something about your father. And they recognize right away his skill, his knowledge, his creativity, mm-hmm. his creativity. Now, it's interesting, and just if you could explain, you know, some people who haven't done this kind of work might think off the top of their head, like me even, like, well, wait a second, you're building something from blueprints and it's pretty much straightforward. Some people, you know, if the word factory comes to mind, which probably doesn't apply. How does creativity apply in something like shipbuilding, being an electrician? I take it you're not just following the manual, or even following the manual does take creativity. Can you talk about creativity and your job and your dad's job?
Creativity comes on a lot of headings. It could be making the job more efficient, making the job safer, the cost. A lot of times you have to improvise. It's like if you've got a plan for a football game, you're going to have to improvise for various different situations. The environment may be different where you're working. I'll think of a couple things off the top of my head, like big reels of cable stored outside, and very, very cold weather. You know, it gets to be 20 below zero here in Maine in the wintertime, and those cables, like, they're about 3 inches diameter, and they're plastic coated, so they're as hard as ever. And if you try to take them off of a reel, they're not going to want to unwind. So a perfect example is a buddy of mine had a creative idea. His name is Andy, and he had this idea to build tents with steam heaters in them. They're readily available at the shipyard, and we'd put these reels of cable inside of those tents, which would warm the cable up so that when you took that cable off the reel and fed it into the ship, it came off like spaghetti rather than coming off like a coil spring. And that's an example of being creative as far as efficiency and safety.
And a million different other ways. No, I just, and forgive me, this line of work, this industry is something I know nothing about, even though I've lived on ships, worked on ships, landed on ships. My little life on the ship was just that, a little life. I went from here to there to there. And
right.
I didn't back then wonder about things like that. But actually every now and then I did. I got to tell you, I remember sitting in the ready room, and actually I think I noticed this as a kid when I got a tour of a ship. You just look at the ceiling, which I can't remember what's the word for ceiling on a ship? It's not ceiling.
Overhead.
Overhead. And you just see this incredible array of cables and ducts and just all this stuff, and it goes every which way. And I do remember being dazzled by how complicated it was.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad that you noticed that, because that's pretty much the way it is. And you saw the finished ship. Imagine as it's being built, how complex it is. What my father and I did a lot together was, you mentioned those cables, where you have these cable runs with hundreds of cables ranging from 4 millimeters in diameter, you know, which is smaller than a pencil, up to 60 millimeters, which is about the size of your forearm. And they're all running on cable runs. And, you know, they go through watertight bulkheads, watertight decks, watertight overheads. And they go through these things called transits. And those transits have to be packed with solid rubber modules around each cable so that those to maintain the watertight and airtight integrity of those bulkheads. Perfect example is when the McCain and the Fitzgerald had those at sea accidents in the past couple of years.
Oh, the collision?
Yes, transits kept those ships from sinking, because if those transits where the cables go through were not water airtight, the water that flooded one compartment would go right into the next compartment, you know, like, and you don't want that to happen. So anyway, my father and I packed transits together a lot together. I mean, we're not only on the same crew, we had a really good supervisor at the time named Jerry. Jerry was brilliant enough to put my father and I together on the same transits so that we could work together. And, you know, when you work together for so long, you don't even have to communicate. One guy knows what the other guy's doing. And we packed these transits. And going back to your creativity, when they run the cables into the ship, you know, they don't always go in perfectly uniform. You know, you have a big tangled mess sometimes around each transit on both sides. And you have to use your creativity to untangle things and make room for your body. And my father and I are both very large men, so you had to make room so you could get up there, so you could see what you were doing, and then you'd have to comb out these cables. I mean, and that's the best way I could describe them. So you want them to all be going pretty much in the same direction, and you want to count them to see how many you have and measure them, and then they have to go in tiers inside of each transit, and then you have to measure each cable diameter from 4 millimeters up to 60 or so, and you have to get the rubber blocks that fit around each one, and you have to lubricate them with this lubricant. It's tallow, and it turns into cement ultimately, and you have to put it all together, and it requires a lot of concentration, a lot of patience, and in the case of the large cables, it requires a lot of arm strength, so which, you know, you just described the qualifications that my late father and I both have, you know, and I love doing stuff like that, especially because no one else liked doing it. And he and I got to be pretty famous for doing it. And then he died in 2005. And then from 2005 until this past November, when I retired, I did it and I just loved it. And on the Zumwalt ship, it was especially stimulating because that used a completely different transpacking system than the DDG-50.
Sorry, before we get to the Zumwalt, I got to ask you about working with your dad.
Sure.
You guys are, you know, you speak each other's language without even speaking and all that. But is it ever a little bit, you know, hey, you're working with your dad all day long. Any downside to that? It sounds beautiful and it sounds, but that's, you know, I mean, and you're obviously you revere your father, but I don't know. Was there anything? A lot of young men would be like, you know, I don't want to be right next to my dad all day long. But I admire your approach, and you're so enlightened and good. But do you know what I mean? You know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean, and no, there was never any rebellion. When I was a kid, my father was, he worked in the automobile dealerships, and he looked so different from the young men that worked for him. You know, the young men with bell bottoms and long hair and zoomy cars and motorcycles. And my father spoke their language, and he did not look down on them. Like you mentioned earlier about people in college, if they looked down their nose at someone who did not go to college, my father was different from other people. He communicated with the young people because he knew they were the future, and they fed off of that. And this is the way I grew up. And not only that, I told you earlier that I was interested in automobiles and high performance and stuff like that. He was involved in all that. And so are those young men. And when they needed something or a guidance or parts or whatever, or connection to another person, he was the go-to guy. And yet they looked so different. This one particular time, this young man who had a motorcycle needed some engine mounts made. And my father was working at a place called United Engineering and Foundry, which was across the street from the steel mill in Youngstown. And in his off time, my father crafted some steel motor mounts for this kid's motorcycle. And I remember this one day I was in the parking lot at that Oldsmobile dealership. I was washing cars. And my father pulled this rag out of his pocket, a red working man's work rag. And he had these motor mounts that he had made for this young man. And I guess it's just like a Norman Rockwell moment. Here's this guy, flat top around, you know, just this straight guy helping this young man with the long hair with his motorcycle. So back to me, I'm taking a long way around the barn here, but my father was the coolest guy I ever saw. I wanted to walk like him, talk like him, be like him, except for the flat top. Hmm. I even wanted to print like him rather than cursive writing. Everything he did was cool. So as far as working with him at Bath Iron Works, it was a dream come true. One of our friends is also, he's a flying buddy of mine, and he's also our attorney. And he said one day after my father died, he said, "Larry, you and your father were closer than twins. You were more like one person than two." So maybe that's the best statement that I could have said to let you know how my father and I got along.
Wow. All right. So some basics about working at Bath Iron Works at a shipyard. What shift did you work generally? What time did you have to be at work?
We worked second shift from 4 to midnight.
For how long did you work 4 p.m. to midnight?
From when I started in January of 80, from 80 to about 86, I went from day shift to second shift and day shift. And that was to either be with a girl or get away from a girl. And in 86, I went on second shift permanently. So from 86 till last November, I was on second shift full time.
That is kind of amazing. 4 p.m. to midnight, the same shift, same place for, 35 years, right?
Right.
All right. So you get off. Do you have to punch in? Is it a punch clock kind of situation?
Well, when we started there, we still had the time, you know, like the IBM card type punch in.
Yeah.
And eventually that turned into, we got these badges where they had the barcode on the bottom. And when I first started there, our badges were round and they just had your picture on them and you just like put it on your lapel. And, but then when they got rid of the time cards, we got a badge that was about the size of a cell phone. And it had a barcode on the bottom and a clip and you'd clip that on.
By the way, there wasn't a third shift, was there, from 12 to 8?
Yeah. Yeah. There are three shifts at the shipyard.
Was the 12 to 8 shift, midnight to 8?
It's like 11:30 to 7:30. Second shift and third shift overlap a little bit because there aren't as many people on both shifts. So there's no parking clashes where day shift works a full shift. I'm not sure what their hours are now, but day shift and second shift were separated by a half an hour, but second shift and third shift overlapped by a half an hour.
So, and I guess, 4 p.m. to midnight is kind of a cool shift. Well, you get off at midnight, and then what did you do? Did you go home? I mean, just have dinner? I mean, did you go right to bed? I am kind of really curious about people's daily routines. I find it fascinating. But I know you got there, you punch in. Midnight, you get off. Then what do you do?
I drove home, which was about an hour. And in the winter months, it could take up to 2 hours, you know, because we get a lot of snow in Maine. And we live up in the woods. So sometimes I'd get home in the wintertime and I'd have to leave the car down on the highway and walk up into the woods and get the snowplow and plow the driveway so that I could get home. We live, like I said, about 3/4 of a mile up. But I'd get home on a regular day and immediately I'd take a shower before I even said hello to my wife because, you know, on the ship there's a lot of dust and insulation dust and stuff, and I didn't want to even expose her in any possible way. So the first thing I do is throw all the clothes in the washing machine, take a shower, and then go talk to my wife for a little while. And I'd get a snack and watch TV and wind down and go to bed. Probably 2 a.m. I'd go to bed.
What did your wife, what was she doing and what's her name?
Julie.
And what was her job? Did she work?
She did. Yeah, she did for a long time. She worked in the post office until about 2000. And then, after that, she worked she's a quilter. She ladies make the quilts, and then she has a machine here where she puts them on and she does the quilting. She puts the quilt on top and she puts the batting in the middle, which is like the foamy part of the quilt, and then the backing. And they give her the top that they sew together, and she gives them a finished quilt when it's done. So that she's a quilter now, but she's semi-retired.
Did she ever grumble like, wouldn't it be nice if you were home for dinner at a normal time?
Not really. No, because she used to always say in a very supportive way, I loved second shift when I worked it. So no, we never really had an issue with that. And when our daughter was growing up, it worked out really nice because one of us was with our daughter almost all the time.
Did you, and what time did you wake up?
Pardon me?
What time did you wake up? You go to bed about 2. What time did you wake up?
Oh, it depends. When our daughter was a baby, I'd get up quite early to tend to that stuff. But as she grew and then she went to school, maybe 10, 11 o'clock.
And then you just kind of, between that and time to go to work, just the kinds of things that people do, right? Take care of the house, whatever there is to do.
Right. See, we, like I said, we live up in the woods, so there's a lot of stuff you do. In the summer, we have a big lawn. I'd cut the grass or I'd cut and split wood because we use a lot of wood heat in our house. In the wintertime, you'd do a lot of plowing or maintenance on the snow plow, just stuff like that. It's a really lovely life. It's very, very old school.
So back to the shipyard. The very first ship you worked on, and you go right into shipping, or was that considered like a privilege to actually be on the ship? Did you have to work your way up to actually doing that kind of work? Was there any kind of an apprentice program you had to go through?
No, there wasn't. No, they did put you through tacking school and a little bit of a safety seminar, and they'd give you a little tour of the shipyard. Of the different techniques, they take you up to the building and show you the upside down units and stuff like that. But no, my father and I both immediately worked on the ships. And the first ship I worked on, all of the ships that I worked on were frigates. Those were the first ones that I worked on, FFGs. And I worked on all of them except for the first five. And the first one I worked on was the Clifton Sprague. And after the frigates, in between the frigates, we did a few commercial ships, a couple of tankers, and I also worked on an Army Corps of Engineers dredge and a 600-foot sugar barge. And then after the frigates and those, then I worked on all of the cruisers. And then after the cruisers, I worked on 37 DDG-51s, and then I worked on the 3 DDG-1000s.
These are incredibly complex machines, vessels. They're just like floating cities, and it's almost impossible.
What?
These are like floating cities, incredibly complex vehicles. Ships.
Extremely complicated. I learned something. I was never not fascinated on the ship. For a mechanic, for an electrician. For a student of high performance, I mean, everything about a ship, every ship that we built there, from the propellers all the way up to the sonar domes, all the way up to the mast, the radar systems, everything is fascinating. For a 13-year-old boy in a 64-year-old body, it's a dream come true.
So here's something, and then you'll tell me, but let me just put this, let's say this, and forgive me for the how simple this question may be, or the question of a simpleton, but if someone is steering the ship, right? Right, and they move the wheel to the right, which moves the rudder. Now, the bridge is a very long way away from that rudder. Imagine it's a electrical connection, or is it a hydraulic connection? There's a plenty of electricity between that steering wheel and that rudder.
And it's electrical and hydraulic, and there's two rudders on most of them.
And if it's electrical and hydraulic, I mean, there are all kinds of lines and tubes that have to connect that steering wheel to that rudder, correct?
Right. If you were to go into the steering gear rooms of the DDG-51, it's all the way in the back of the ship. It's got a pretty low overhead because the profile of the ship back there is low on top, and the underside of the deck has to come up because the propellers are underneath. It's a real cramped but wide compartment, and it's just filled with hydraulic cylinders and all kinds of motors and lots of electrical stuff. And the interesting part about the rudders is there's actually if the rudder system were not to work, there's these huge threaded rods on them where I think if the system failed, you could have sailors on either side clicking up and down. You could move the rudders manually with these large wrenches.
So that is just, it's beyond comprehension how one does that. How does one do that? I mean, you have these blueprints, you don't just show up and start working. How does this actually, how is this done? You get there, you don't just have at it. Like, what is the process?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I can understand why you would ask that. Well, each department has a foreman and assistant foreman. And then they have lead men or supervisors or lead ladies. And then they have work leaders who are between the management, the supervisors, and the workers. So as far as experience goes, you would get the more experienced people, and they would train the younger people that came in. When I first came into the shipyard, I worked alongside guys that some of them were just on the verge of retiring. They had worked there during World War II. And so they pass along that experience, those methods, that communication, the terms that they use. Some of the terms are X-rated. It's a guy thing. They pass that information along, and the young people like me would see how it was done and mimic them and try to improve, and usually couldn't because those guys had everything down pat. And the guys that I worked for when I first started the shipyard were real role models for me, mechanically and spiritually. You know, there was this one guy, his name was Dewey, and he's a really sweet guy. And when you're in your 20s and you got a little bit of edge to your personality, which I did at times, like I'm sure everybody does, most guys do anyway. And Dewey said, you know, one time I was really mad. He said, you know what, Larry, this is their ball game. You got to play their game and you're going to do fine. And I'll always remember that when he said that, because there's this big guy and he was just about as rebellious as I could imagine a person. And yet he said, Larry, you just got to go along with them. It was a real good lesson. And on top of that, he showed me how to do things mechanically, how to find things and how to create things. And, you know, in the old catacombs of Bath Ironworks, where you could find things that non-standard way of accomplishing the job efficiently and safely. And good guys, really good guys.
And sounds like the bosses there, the upper management, they must have been pretty good. Or was there the resentment? I mean, you know, look, lots
Never.
Of people. No?
No. No, no, no resentment at all. No, they're very supportive, and I would. Bath Iron Works is an interesting place, really interesting. It's like I try to refer it to. This is the Rolls Royce of shipyards. I mean, they build the best ships. The people at Bath Iron Works, they go back four, sometimes more than that, generations. I worked for a lady. Her first name's Lily. Her great grandfather sold the wooden pilings to Thomas Hyde, who started Bath Iron Works. I mean, that's how far back these people go. You have three or four, maybe even more, of a family working at the shipyard. And Bath Iron Works management recognizes that. You know, they refer to it as a Bath Iron Works family. And they cultivate that. And it's in everyone's best interest. Perfect example is my father and I. I'll go back to that. My supervisor, Jerry, he put us together on purpose, and it was, you know, it was so productive. And on top of that, it was such a good, we were such a good team. It made it such a good role model for others. And it's been done before. I know some couples that work together at the shipyard. I'm thinking of them as you brought this subject up. They have man and wife working together. There's a couple. I won't give you the last name. Her name is Sue and his name is Dick. And they're ship fitters. and they work together every single day. And you can imagine the productivity and the that's the best way I could put it. The productivity that those people, they got an award on the Zumwalt from the captain of the ship at the time, because they performed one of the most difficult operations. They had to remove 600, they were called 600 gussets, big, huge steel gussets that had to be cut out with cutting torches after the ship was put in the water. And this couple did that on their own. So as far as management goes, to go back to what you mentioned, management recognizes, they recognize a good thing and they utilize it when they do. So no, there's no resentment at all.
Can I just, off duty, and I do have some detailed questions about your work in a second again, but vacations, 2 weeks a year, I guess, and right?
Oh, we got more than that. When you first start there, I think you get a week or so. But I think after 30 years, I think that's what it is, you get 7 weeks.
7 weeks. And did you take them all?
Oh, yeah.
In a row?
I didn't. I get in big trouble with my wife. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you the truth. A lot of it gets used because of weather. Sometimes we get some really ugly weather up here in Maine. And like I said, I live up in the woods, and if you can't even get out of your driveway, you can't go. So they can't, I would say maybe 2 or 3 weeks out of the 7 was used just for safety purposes. Don't go to work in an ice storm, stuff like that. And then you have to use it. It's not really vacation and sick time. It's called compensated time. That encapsulates the sick and the vacation. So, and of course you might have to use a week or two if you're sick. So,
now, what about this?
It's pretty generous.
They're not always building ships, or are they? I mean, it seems, you know, ships are, the government buys a bunch of ships and then they don't buy a bunch of ships. So were there spells where there was no work?
I've never run into that. There are spells where it subsides. For instance, in 89, Bath Iron Works had 12,000 employees. We were really at our peak. And now I believe there's half that number at the shipyard. But I never got to the point. I was never laid off. Some people have been, but I was never laid off, thankfully.
I would imagine a lot of luminaries went through there, Secretary of the Navy, Secretary of Defense, maybe a president or two. Did you meet anyone like that?
Yes, I didn't. The most amazing people I ever met, of course, were the Zumwalts, and I met President Johnson's daughters. They were really nice, and some secretaries of the Navy came through several times. But I Bill Clinton was there once, but I never met him. As a matter of fact, when he was there, I was flying over the shipyard. I was videotaping the ship that. The day he was there, my father and I, we used to have Cessna airplanes. And from the late 80s until the late 90s, we flew over like 8 or 9 different ship launchings. They have dramatic ship launches, you know, they don't do that anymore. And we used to, and it's uncontrolled airspace. I'm sure you want to know about that. And we would be at, you know, 1,500, 2,000 feet, and we videotaped. And one of my goals in my retirement years, I don't know if I'll get to it, but it's all on VHS tapes. I like to edit them and put them on a thumb drive or DVDs or whatever. But no, I never met any really big, important people.
By the way, let me ask you about the flying. When you say dramatic ship launches, like we've seen them on TV, they break the bottle of champagne and the ship slides into the water or to the side. Are you talking about those and they're not done anymore?
The one where the ship goes... It slides down lengthwise right into the river, and it's pretty cool. Pretty cool to see that from the air. It's really cool. Do you want me to describe it?
Well, do they do that anymore?
No. The way they do it now is much more efficient. The ship is built on level. It's called a land level facility. It's built on level ground rather than on the ways where they're the inclined ways. It's built on the level ground, and then when the ship they have it on like railroad tracks. And it goes like at a half a mile an hour when it's ready to go into the dry dock. And then the dry dock goes out into the river and it submerges and it launches the ship. It's it takes several hours. And it's not dramatic at all, but it's very, very efficient because you build the ship on level ground. Whereas when the ships were built on the inclined ways, you really couldn't use a level because the ship wasn't on level ground. So you had to use levels that had these pieces of wood on them called declivity boards. And that was like the angle that the inclined ways was. So that's how when you put light legs or something, you know, you built a ship very much like you build a house. Things have to be level when you set them in place and tack weld them. And so to make a long story short, they put the ships into the water now through a dry dock.
Now, you became a pilot. You're flying. I'm sorry, did you own your own Cessnas?
I own two Cessnas and an Aronca Champ.
What's an Aronca Champ?
It's like a Piper Cub. It's an old tube and fabric airplane with a 65-horse engine that you have to start it up by turning the propeller, that kind.
So let me ask you something. You've got three airplanes between you and your dad?
I did, not anymore.
Now, you guys, here you are. This is a trade, and kind of going back to my college question, you can do very well. I mean, look, I know that these planes sometimes, you can own a plane and not be rich, but still, what's going on there? Three airplanes, that's something else. And, you know, we hear about maybe you've heard of that book, The Barber, The Millionaire Barber, that sometimes people can accumulate wealth if they save, you know, diligently, live modestly, and you can achieve great things financially. Is that what's going on here a little bit?
I'm not sure. That's kind of deep for me.
It's also probably, forgive me, none of my business. So let me just ask you that.
Oh, no, I like the question. I take it as a compliment. No, aviation, like I said, high performance was always number one in our family, with automobiles and with aircraft. And my father's brother was a flight instructor, and he was killed in World War II. And aviation has always been really big in our family. I mean, big. And when I was in the mid-80s, and I was racing cars, I used to go to the airport to get gasoline for my race car. And, man, I saw an airplane for sale, and I could afford that. I was single, and I had money, and I really wanted to fly. And so in 1985, I bought an airplane, a 58 Cessna 172, and got my pilot's license that summer. And I bought a Cessna 170, and then I bought this Aronca because it was an old tailwheel type, you know, and it's a different way to land.
I guess, let me ask you this. You have a 172. Why do you buy a one? Why do you get a second airplane? What's the difference between a 170 and a 172, by the way?
Okay, 172 has 145 horse. It's a high wing monoplane, 4-seat, and it has a nose wheel. And the 170, and then I sold that. And then I bought the Aronca with the 65 horse because I wanted to fly something different. And it had a tail wheel, you know, and the stick, you know, and the rudder. It didn't have yokes, it had stick. And it was fun. And then I bought the Cessna 170 because it was like a combination of both. It had a tail wheel and it had yokes. And I didn't own them all at the same time. I owned them over a period of, you know, from 85 until 2000.
What airport did you fly out of? What airport did you keep these?
Wiscasset, Maine.
And it's a paved runway, right?
Yeah, 3,400 feet. And it's halfway between here and Bath Iron Works. So some days on my way to work, I'd fly the airplane and then go to work. And some days after work and, you know, at night, I'd go to the airport and fly around. I'd fly 100 miles away and do a touch and go and come back and land. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. No, it's really great. I highly recommend it.
Well, you're a pilot. You know what it's like.
True. But I never owned my own plane. That's really impressive. So, can you tell me a little bit about, now you have, Maya told me this, and I think you actually wrote it down, and I saw this, and you have a bit of claustrophobia, right?
Yes.
So in your profession would require you at times to go into really, really cramped places to fix something, install something, whatever, right?
Right. Yes.
How did you manage that?
Man, I sucked it up. It's all you can do. I'm big. I'm 6'1", 260 pounds, and I have huge shoulders, and but they come in handy when you want to move a car. But when you're in a tight spot, it's and you get all squeezed in there. I almost drowned when I was a kid. I always wondered if that had something to do with it. My father saved my life. He dove in and saved me. I always wondered if, because I almost drowned once, that caused me to be claustrophobic later in life. But I worked in some really, really tight spots on the ships. But, you know, honest to God, I just sucked it up and thought, you know, some guys have it a lot worse than me. Sometimes I just close my eyes and breathe deep and get over it. Sometimes I just got the hell out of there. It just depended on how bad it was. I think the worst ones is when you have to climb on top of an airlock, you know, that are between zones, and you know, have to open one door and close it, and then your ears pop, and then if you're on top of an airlock, and then I'm laying on my stomach, and then I can feel the overhead on my back, you know, it's like, oh man, I could get crushed if something dropped on the overhead on the deck above me. And it was just, it's all just mental, mental defect.
Hey, this sounds, go ahead.
I just, best way to put it is the way I put it at the beginning. I just manned up.
Yeah, no, totally get it. This sounds silly, but, you know, in a lot of jobs, office politics, you've got to compete for whatever. It sounds to me like you didn't have to deal with any of that stuff. For a lot of the company was great. You worked with great people, and it was the job was cut and dried in a way. It was complex. It was all these things, but something physical had to be completed, had to be achieved. And, you know, it wasn't a bunch of a competition for idea or attention. It was just, anyway, did you have to play office politics ever? I guess not. You're not in the office.
No, there wasn't office politics. It was a fertile atmosphere. I mean, the guys I worked with, oh my God, the absolute best guys that had the same interests as me, not really the aviation, but the guys I worked with, like my friend Andy, high performance automobiles, and he was born on a farm, raised on a farm. He's the kind of guy that he's very much like my father. He could make something out of nothing. I mean, he just retired a couple of weeks ago. And no, the guys I worked with, and the ladies at the shipyard are terrific. They're very cool, very knowledgeable, fearless, not afraid to climb up and do the same work that a guy that twice their size, 100 pounds more, would do. It's a really good, fertile, healthy atmosphere.
All right, that's excellent. Did you ever get to, like, look, these ships, you build them, and then did you ever see, you told me from the air you saw some, but did you ever go, or would they have you attend the commissioning ceremonies? And by the way, actually, let me ask you about this. There isn't just a commissioning ceremony. There's a keel-laying ceremony. There's a commissioning ceremony. There's a, what are the three big moments in a ship's life?
Oh, I think the first big moment is the contract for it. That's just my guess. And then there's once they cut the steel, that's when they start cutting the steel out at that Harding's plant that I told you about out in Brunswick. That's when they've cut the first piece of steel for a ship. And that's a big deal. And then when they build the first unit in the buildings, and then when they lay the keel, I think that's, they lay the keel is more of a symbolic ceremony now, where they used to literally lay a keel down first and then start building the ship on top of it. But since they build the ships in units now, I think it's more a set date to celebrate a quote unquote keel laying.
What do you mean they build a ship in units?
That's a good question. The ships aren't, years ago, the ships used to be built outside from the ground up. And they have assembly buildings at Bath Iron Works where they build the ships in numerous, I'm not sure what the correct number is, it might be about 30 different units, where they build them, first they build them upside down so that they can do all of the overhead stuff, and they can weld it in a comfortable, efficient way. And then they turn the units back right side up. They sandblast them, they paint them, they insulate them, and then they start installing all of the equipment. So the ships are built in units first, separate units in the buildings, and they're brought out with a huge caterpillar-type tractor, brings them out, and then they assemble the units out on the land level facility. And so it's like big building blocks of a ship.
Yeah, you know, once I
So back to your milestones. So after they do the keel laying, then they have the ship launch, or the float off is what they call it. And they have one called the mast stepping ceremony, which is that's essentially what it is. It's a ceremony where some mementos of the namesake of the ship are all put into a secret box that go into the ship, coins or medals or medallions or letters or something. They have the mast stepping ceremony, and then they have the christening, the big ceremony where the mother or a dignitary lady breaks a bottle of champagne on the bow of the ship and the balloons go in the air.
Very cool. No, it's
then they have the commissioning after the ship. And then they have the delivery, where they deliver the ship and they literally hand the keys of the ship to the Navy. Now the Navy owns it.
Is there such a thing? There's a set of keys to the ship?
I couldn't tell you.
But they basically take possession of the ship.
They take possession, and then at that point, I think the Navy starts. This is just my opinion. I think the Navy starts paying Bath Iron Works for their pier time, where they tie their now the ship is there, so it's like a rental unit. I think that's when they start paying to have their ship at Bath Iron Works, so Bath Iron Works can finish it. And then after it's delivered to the Navy, and you know, it goes on sea trials and stuff like that. And then once the ship is completely done and the sailors are on board and it leaves permanently, then it goes to the commissioning ceremony.
Yeah.
And I've been to one commissioning. I went to the Zumwalt's commissioning in Baltimore, and it was pretty cool.
So is there ever a situation where, like, when that ship is going through its trials, you never go out to sea with a ship, right?
No, that's reserved. And I understand it. It's reserved in my department for the electronics specialists and for supervisors and members of management of our department. But no, construction electricians don't go on sea trials.
So is there ever a fear? Do you ever get feedback like, something went wrong with system X, or this may have happened? We might have made a mistake. You know, look, if a plane crashes, there's a big investigation, and sometimes they figure out that, oh, yeah, in the manufacturing, there was a problem, and we got to change this. Do they ever have issues, and they talk to you guys about what might have caused it?
Yes, there have, and that's not uncommon with any ship or anything, quite frankly, but nothing disastrous. And nothing that I would say would be complaint worthy. It's just the nature of the business. A ship is an extremely complex piece of equipment, and I don't think Bath Iron Works has ever done anything wrong. If anything had ever, and I don't really know of too many instances, if anything ever did go wrong, it was most likely with a piece of equipment from a subcontractor, you know, something fizzled out or something like that, and it was simply a matter of taking that piece of equipment out and putting a new piece in. But when Bath Iron Works builds a hull of a ship, the HULL, the hull of a ship, it's the best built ship you're going to get.
Such pride in your work. By the way, when you're not, okay, we talked about your 7 weeks of vacation and you're flying. What about your faith? We talked about that earlier briefly, but tell me, did you go to church every week?
Oh, no. I wish that I could. But no, my wife's a church-going Christian. She's going tomorrow to Easter services, East Sunrise services, and No, I'm a Christian, but I don't go to church as much as I should, and maybe I'll be shamed into it now.
Oh, no. Are you a, do you read the Bible?
No, I don't. No, I have, but I have faith. Julie and I, my wife and I just spoke about it. I watched Ben-Hur last night with tears in my eyes. I feel sorry for people that don't have faith. That I really do. Like I said, my heroes are my mom and Jesus. When I see what they put poor Jesus through, and he forgave everyone. I mean, I even said to my wife, I said, even if you aren't a Christian, even if you don't believe, look what that man went through historically.
So let me ask you, politically, when Donald Trump started, are you a Trump supporter? And if you don't feel like talking about it, that's fine. But I am curious. You are?
I am.
Were you, say, the first time he ran, did you, he campaigned a lot in Maine, I believe, right?
I think so. I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. I'm not a big political guy, to tell you the truth. I'll support a guy. I can give you a personal firsthand story about Trump. A lot of people, even my brother, doesn't care for him, but I can tell you there was a strike at Bath Iron Works last summer. It was one of the things that compelled me to retire, because I checked on my annuities and I realized that my annuities equaled or exceeded my income. So that combined that with COVID, and it made it an easy decision to retire, because I didn't want to bring COVID home to my wife and to her 97-year-old father. But when we were on strike, when the union was on strike last summer, Donald Trump sent some mediators up here to Maine and told the company and the union, you start negotiating and you get those people back to work. And within a few weeks, we were back to work. So he was the catalyst in getting me back to work last year, minimizing the amount of money I lost because we were on strike. So the man helped me. And when you help me, you get my support.
That makes perfect sense. So let's talk a little bit about the Zumwalts. Admiral Zumwalt was the chief of naval operations, a real legendary officer. It's no surprise that they decided to name a ship for him, or a class of ships for him, the Zumwalt class. You said that work on that ship came to you at a time where you were looking for a new challenge. What was... just tell us a little bit about that time in your life. You had just lost your father, right?
Wow, that's a really good question, and this could be a volume. My father died in 2005. I went from a happy-go-lucky son who I had that buffer, I had that safety net of my father. If anything ever happened to me, flying my airplane or something like that, my wife and my daughter, who was 9 years old at the time, would be taken care of. My father was always there. So when he died, and he died so quickly, one minute I saw him and I gave him a kiss and hug and told him I loved him, and I took my kid for a sled ride, and the next minute I found him dead. And so I was pretty upset from 2005 until about 2011. In 2011, the Zumwalt ship came into my life, and it coincided with that six-year period of time where I was told I could have been sued. So now that six-year period of time is gone, and I've got this ship in front of me that looks like a spaceship of the sea. I described it to Mazetta Zumwalt Weathers, who's become a friend of our family. First time I saw it, the conceptual drawings of it, I said, it looks like it's part submarine, part battleship, and part spaceship. I mean, if you look at the deck house, it looks like one of Buck Rogers' original spaceships from the 1930s. It's an absolute freak show. It's so cool.
Yeah.
And so that ship came into my life, and I just exploded with enthusiasm because I was so, it was a sense of relief for my life. And it was a sense of excitement because, man, I had something in front of me that was really cool. And it was the most stimulating period of my shipbuilding career. And it's amazing because it took place in the last quarter of my 40 years there.
So you got to know the Zumwalt family, including Maya. And now Admiral Zumwalt had a son, Admiral Elmo Zumwalt III. And famously, he came down with, I think, well, a form of cancer, lymphoma, and may have been brought on by a decision made by the father, right? Agent Orange was used, a defoliant in Vietnam. Famous story, my father, my son. So lots of folks are aware of that. He decided, I didn't know this until very recently, but he's not buried anywhere. I guess his remains were cremated, correct?
Correct.
Now you got to know Maya, I guess, the, who is the granddaughter of the Admiral. And
correct.
You learned this, that she, you knew, you learned this about her. How did that come up, by the way?
About him being cremated?
Yeah, not having, her not having a place to, you know, go.
My daughter went to college in Pennsylvania, and she went down to visit Mrs. Zumwalt Weathers a couple of times for Easter. And she got, it was really sweet. They became so close that they're like, my daughter is like their, Mazetta's niece now. They're so close. Anyway, I asked my daughter one day because some questions about Elmo. I said, I wonder where he's buried, because when mommy and I go down to see Admiral Zumwalt's headstone at Annapolis, I'd like to go see where Elmo's headstone is too. And she said, oh, Daddy, there's no headstone. I said, why? And she said, well, his remains are cremated. And honest to God, sir, instantly, I thought, oh, my God, I got to do something. And I had a whole stash of metal that I had bought from Bath Iron Works Recycling over the years. And a lot of it was from the Zumwalt ship. And I instantly, and I even explained this to Maya, it wasn't like a decision. It was like the next step in life. I knew that I had to make something three-dimensional, something that she could touch, something that the future generations of Elmo's family could have. And I came up with, you know, a couple of pretty cool concepts. And one of the pieces of metal that I had was a piece of stainless steel from the ship. It was almost an inch thick, I think. And I just visualized all the letters of Elmo's name, Elmo R. Zumwalt, and then a Roman numeral 3. I visualized all those letters, and then I visualized making a like female sockets in a bar across it, and all the letters would be able to come out. You know, you could put them in, and it would say his name, but individual could take one letter out. And so if his family all got together, everybody could hold a letter of his name, or if possibly his old crewmates were to get together, everybody could hold a letter of his name all at once. And I worked on that for about 3 months, and all of the metal from it came from the Zumwalt ship. And I worked on that for 3 months, and it was, honest to God, it was almost an out-of-body experience. I didn't back up one step. Everything I did was positive, which usually doesn't happen with something that's a prototype, and especially with me. And it was so much fun to make. And I thought of Elmo the whole time. It was like he was here. And honest, it was really moving experience. And as I was working with the wood pieces for it, I came up with a cool idea. There's a cavity in the back of it. And I asked the Zumwalt family if anybody would like to write a note to Elmo that they could send it to me, and I would install it inside of this and then seal the cavity permanently so that these notes, these loving notes, would be inside of it forever. And that's exactly what happened. And Elmo's son, Russell, sent one too, which was really moving. And I put them all inside and sealed it and finished it. And it was that if I'm known for anything other than being, you know, my daughter's father, my wife's husband and my parents' son. I want to be known for making that memorial for Elmo. I could just start crying now thinking about it. I don't know how I did it, but I'm pretty proud of that.
That's pretty great. That really is. And I know how much they cherish that and you. So let me just ask you this. Overall, life in retirement, how is it? Do you miss work? And how are you occupying yourself? What do you do these days?
Man, those are good questions. I miss the shipyard terribly, but not so much that I'd go back. I adore that shipyard. Absolutely adore it. And the people, are terrific. They really are. My best friends, if I wanted a ship built, that's where I'd want it built. I spent 40 years there. I worked at Bath Iron Works more than I've done anything. I love that shipyard. And I want it to do well. I really do. I think that's the way most people feel when they retire. My best friends, a lot of them have retired recently. I'm in that group. You know, there are a lot of retirees now. What am I doing now? What was the other question?
I guess it was you miss it, number one. Number two, what are you doing? Because, you know, your life has changed rather dramatically.
Yeah, okay. That's it. It has changed dramatically and for the better. I'll tell you, every day feels like Saturday. My wife had to get me one of those clocks that has the day written on it because I lost track of what day it was. Honest to God. So I'd look at it. Oh, it's Saturday, or it's Monday. What do I do every day? I take care of my father-in-law. He's almost 98 years old. His name is Ralph Bond. He flew B-24 bombers in World War II, but luckily he never got deployed because the war ended at the end of his training, and he feels bad about that. He's the best man in the world. He's so good, raised four children, selfless, really good man. He's a farmer, built houses for his kids, and he couldn't go into a nursing home after his wife predeceased him, so he couldn't live alone either. So my wife and I had him move in with us 4 years ago. So I tend to him a lot. He lives in one of our bedrooms, and he reads and watches TV in the living room. And I take care of his needs. We do cooking, and he has a portable bathroom in his room. And it's a really fulfilling task every day taking care of him. You know, my father's brother was killed in World War II, and my mother's uncle was killed in World War II, both heroes, both pilots. And I can't take care of them or do anything for them, but I can do something for one of their buddies. And it's a real, real honor to be able to take care of Ralph. And other than that, my brother has a little landscaping company, and all of his trucks are old. They're antiques. And so I like I said earlier about metals and welding, after I'm done talking to you today, I'm going to go down there and start working on it. So I'm putting new floors and new rocker panels and new doors on his 1960 Ford dump truck. And so I work for my brother, and it's a real loving relationship with my brother, Tim. And he worked at Bath Iron Works for a few years. And so that's what I do. I take care of my father-in-law. I love my wife. I talk to my daughter on the telephone almost every day, and I work in the garage on vehicles.
Sounds like a perfect life in many ways. What does your daughter do now?
My daughter works for a major American company overseas. That's all I'm allowed to say.
That's, I like it. Very intriguing. Listen, I could talk to you for several more hours, and if you don't mind,
I could talk too if you want to. I was really nervous, now I'm very excited, and I'm in the groove.
So let's. I'd like to do a part two at some point. We have to leave it there for now. But this is. It's just been a real treat for me, and I know why Maya is so, you know, the whole Zumwalt family, why they're so fond of you. And it just makes total sense to me. So let's pick this up again in a couple of weeks. We're gonna put this up online in a couple of days. But I'd like to talk to you again, if that's all right.
I am just so flattered by this, and I'm very moved to a man of your stature, and of your experience and your patriotism, and I just can't thank you enough for doing this. And anything you need, sir.
Special person, right? Wow. Seems to be at total peace, you know, with the world, with himself, with the. I like that. I like him, the expertise, and who knew, you know? These jobs are being done. We need them. And that is what makes America so great, by the way. Those kinds of. I don't know. I am very impressed. Very, very impressed. Before I go, I do want to remind you, if you want easy and crazy cheap passport renewal, download the It's Easy app from the App Store. It's easy. ITSEASY. And why? It is like the best way to have your passport ready to go as soon as the world opens up. I did it, and I believe so should you. It's easy. In the meantime, once again, thank you to our executive producer who met Larry Stegna while he was building a ship in honor of her grandfather. Isn't that amazing? Maya Zumwalt, our executive producer, Matt Bailey, our editor. We will talk soon. See you on Newsmax for updates. You can always check out Twitter, which is getting a lot of attention lately. At Greg Kelly USA. All the best, and thank you.